introduction to the Common Guild of Katrina Brown. This is actually 10 years, I think, since Katrina and I and Kizzy Anderson first started a series of events called Primers, in which we invited artists to show work or to give talks about work in progress or about their practice in general without the normal format of the Arts Talk, which is an exhibition that opened yesterday, and a sense of perhaps exhaustion attending it for the poor artists I speak. So we hope it's a generous invitation to artists and audiences to think about someone's work at key moments ahead of a future project. And this is one of a number of talks that have taken place at the university with amazing artists, Jimmy Durham, memorably here, Jared Brown, also Phil Collins, Simon Starling, Sharon Hayes, and many others you've worked in the Common Guild's brilliant program over the last 11 years. Katrina is the director of the Common Guild, a graduate of the university, so it's always a pleasure to say welcome back. You probably know her very well, so I won't list all of her accomplishments, but just to note that Katrina also, with the Common Guild, curated Scotland's participation in the Venice Biennale in 2013, which led to memorable works by three artists and a Turner Prize nomination for Duncan Campbell, which he subsequently won. Katrina also was the director of Glasgow International in 2010 and 2012, and so the city owes her a great deal in terms of the artists she's brought, and it's an honour to invite her back to say something about this new strand of Common Guild programming, a place for the work of a human being. And I was struck, Katrina, as maybe the audience was coming in, how quickly this sounds like a political slogan when you put it in front of an institution, maybe particularly a university, a place for the work of a human being. So please join me in welcoming Katrina Brown and also Nicole Francis.
Thanks, Dominic. It's always a pleasure to be in Glasgow University. As Dominic said, I was a student here. But it's also particularly nice to be in this room. It's one of the few rooms left that looks a bit like the university did when it was built here in 1870. Glasgow University, for those of you who don't know, is the fourth oldest in the UK. It dates back to 1451. This building's not quite as old as that, although these benches might make you feel like it is. George Gilbert Scott designed the building, and as part of this lecture theatre, which we've used before, as Dominic said, we're very fond of, the benches that you're sitting on were brought from the original university site on High Street. So they're even older than the building that surrounds them. This space, and hopefully other spaces in the university, are just some of the spaces around Glasgow that we're using for this new series of talks, some of which were built for purposes that have long since evaporated. Good examples being church spaces that are now used for other kind of events and activities. And the title of the series, A Place for the Work and the Human Being, is borrowed from, it actually started life as a lecture by an artist called Ray Zhao, and he delivered it originally in Basel in 1986. The main title is The Art Museum of My Dreams. And he delivered the lecture and its content largely as a sort of counterpoint to a lot of the, let's say, vagaries of postmodernism that was preponderant in museum architecture at that time. And it was really a kind of way of just working through as an artist what he was hoping for. And it seemed like a really fitting title for us in this year when we are looking at relocating to a different building to think about, well, what do we need now? What's the space for not just the artwork, but the artwork in the public realm? How do we make that function today? What does it need? And it seemed very quickly like the best way to do that was through the perspectives, the vital perspectives of the three different professions, if you like, that are involved in that context. The first, and perhaps most importantly, being the artist. And Nicole's here representing that particular strand tonight. The other being, of course, the architects who make these places and spaces for us. And the third strand being curators, critics and others that are involved in thinking about creating this public zone in which we encounter the artwork. I really couldn't be more delighted that Nicole said yes to be number one, because she's a brilliant artist, and lots of you will know Nicole through her participation in the Turner Prize exhibition, which was at Tramway in 2015. And Nicole is native German, born and brought up in Germany, studied in Hamburg. London originally to study at St Martin's.
Uh-huh.
And you've been based there since the early 2000s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as well as being a sort of globally active artist, Nicole is currently professor at the Academie der Bildenden Künste in Munich. And you may or may not say a little bit about that, but I know you're going to talk initially about your own work, particularly through the exhibition that you made last year in Hamburg. And as Dominic said, we'll then have some time for questions towards the end. I also wanted to just say a few words, because I know it's a weird old time in the world just now. I think it's really great to see so many people in a room to think about art, and it reminds me of a text that Jennifer Higgy wrote for Frieze a couple of years ago about the solace of art. And when everything else is going crazy, I think it's great that we all want to look at and think about artworks. Also, just as a counterpoint, there's quite a lot of women involved in this series, and that's a counterpoint to all these men that are on the walls around us. So I'm going to switch this off and hand over to Nicole, and thank you so much for being here. So we'll speak up later.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me, Katrina, and for coming, Bill, and for you to come here today. I've always liked guided tours as a format to connect and structure architecture, movement, and narrative. In fact, my MA thesis at St. Martin actually was a guided tour through a fictitious building, which kind of took the tour that the manager of the Overlook Hotel gives to Jack and Wendy Torrance at the beginning of the film The Shining. So instead of the classical chronological artist talk, the first half of today's presentation is a kind of walkthrough. A survey show I did last year at the Kunstverein in Hamburg, entitled, the show is called Women Between Buildings. And the theme of moving through architecture continues with a video I will show at sort of between the first and the second half of the talk called Palisades from 1998, which is actually still filmed while I was a student in Hamburg, which lasts about 5 minutes. It was the oldest show in the exhibition in Hamburg and is sort of reaching to the second half, which is a sort of excerpt of a presentation I gave in Maria Muller's seminar about maintenance art at the Academy of Fine Arts in Munich last year. I won't actually be talking much about maintenance art, but rather aspects of it which relate to my own interests, mainly a reflection on different relationships with architecture. So it's a bit of an experimental format. I hope it's gonna work out. So the Kunstverein in Hamburg, which you know is the sort of this is a sort of entrance area. It's upstairs of a building that used to be a former market hall, and exhibiting in it and a sort of massive 1,000 square meters was a somewhat scary prospect for me. However, both the building's former commercial function and the size were also aspects I felt drawn to, because the space, although you inside actually almost feels like you're being outdoors. It's entirely enclosed by windows and looks out to some of my favorite, I'm gonna get into it eventually. It's coming out, I can feel it, it's almost there. Favorite buildings of mine, which I call the Cityhöfe, which is a set of brutalist buildings, four sort of monolith buildings that are sort of set behind each other, which, although being listed, I was just saying to Simon, are in the process of being demolished. So the mixing of indoors and outdoors of private and public space was, in a way, also the threat for the theme of the show. The title Women Between Buildings is a reference to Jan Gehl's book Life Between Buildings from 1971 about the use of public space and urban planning. And the long hello, oops, well, you don't see that. The long hello, which is a sort of floor work that you can see here, is a walkable floor sculpture produced especially for the Kunstverein. It's made of industrially manufactured materials and surfaces, which are used in entrance areas of corporate and public spaces. Ah, oh, now we...
Hello there.
Hi. The shapes are connected by a rear system of interlocking mats and individual steel clamps. Aluminium entrance mat systems alternate with rubber mats, mat flaps, and coconut mats, extending the usually very short moment of entering a building about 20 meters into the space of the Kunstreihe. The materials are designed to remove dirt from your shoes or prepare you for the inside of the building. When walking on the Long Hello, you can sense alternating haptic features of the floor surfaces and hear the different sounds that your steps produce on different materials. Visitors enter in a sort of figure-ground relationship when walking the 20 meters and become, in a way, part of the work. The title, The Long Hello, refers to a simple greeting that marks the beginning of an interaction and simultaneously frames it. The work looks at how architecture and design-related condition can structure our social relationships. And while the linguistic frame of the imagined conversation remains unaltered, the material context of the situation of entering and greeting changes each time you set one sets foot on a new ground surface. So this type of urban entrances, passageways, and in-between areas is something that I've been interested in for a long time. And between 2004 and 2012, I produced, now I know what it is. Between 2004 and 2010, I produced the sculptures of the untitled force field series that refers to security exits, security detectors at the exit of department stores. These anti-shoplifting detectors to the right and left of the exit are usually made of inconspicuous gray plastic. They're part of the urban landscape that structure public space, clearly marking the transit area where public space becomes a commodity and the pedestrian turns into a consumer. So at the beginning, the sculptures looked like this. They were actually mimicking the sort of twin structure of those security detectors. Later on, I produced also larger pieces, which you actually had to sort of walk through as a whole. This one is in an exhibition called Doors and Bouncers. And in order to get into the show, you had to step through the ring. My sculptures this type of sculptures are made from patinated and stainless steel, and they take up on the invisible effect of the security devices without actually producing any radiation themselves. The untitled force fields are participatory objects that can be physically stepped through. They create thresholds where no visible spaces are actually being separated. And this work, which is now back in the Kunstreihe, is called Untitled Force Field Spa, and it's from 2010. And it's unique in the way that you can walk through it three ways, whereas earlier pieces, as I showed you, remained in the classic twin structure or with larger single rings fitted into doorways. The wall works entitled mood boards are adapted ready-mades involving modified, ready-made, foldable baby-changing units that you would find in a public bathroom. In everyday life, these objects provide horizontal work surfaces in small rooms to perform an intimate ritual. For my mood boards, I cast different colored terrazzo into different models of the baby changing units. And I kind of was very particular. I didn't want to use a sort of terrazzo that you get in a, you know, posh Italian palazzo, the sort of fine and small stone type of terrazzo, but rather the sort of bigger, more rough appearing and terrazzo that you find in a small Italian bar or something where the pieces of stone are actually offcuts from more prestigious jobs. While the baby changing units with their smooth plastic rounded corners and belts meet today's hygiene and safety standards, the irregularly patterned terrazzo floor is especially popular in public spaces as dirt and signs of wear hardly show up on it. The floor traditionally at the bottom end of the architectural canyon of values is elevated to the level of display. Architectural hierarchies as well as historical and contemporary features of public space get kind of remixed and ordinary patterns of behavior undermined. The mood boards are a good example of my way of working. I usually have a sort of, or there is usually a sort of conceptual or structural frame, an interest in an existing object category, or the sort of structural role that a particular object plays in our lives. I usually start working with observations and photographs for a very long time. Like, I have a large archive of baby changing units in, you know, international restrooms, and that's kind of how slowly I kind of develop a structure for what I want to do with it. I'm interested in how we can undermine given functions of objects and spaces, which determine behavioral patterns, how to recover some of the running room that Hal Foster or Karl Kraus talk about as being lost in our through-and-through designed everyday life. So the origin of many of my works lie in this sort of deliberate misuse or misappropriation, purposeful misuse, or an alternative perception of space. A lot of my works deal with moments of transit in urban life, incidental gestures or actions that we actively perform or passively endure. One of those is locking one's bike to a public bicycle rack before entering a building. The bicycle rack sculpture, sort of a stupid title, but may come up with a better one. I designed the wavy steel tube structure of it, which kind of loosely refers to tubular steel furniture, but it is almost buried in the heap of bicycles that are locked to it, which are more or less disregarding the ordering structure of the bicycle rack. This sort of clutter in big life, big city life, is often an obstacle and directly opposes the present-day imperative of mobility. I'm making a very large version of this at the moment as an outdoor sculpture with Urbane Künste Ruhr, where the bicycles are all actually welded to the structure, which kind of even more with that. And it's going to be located very close to a motorway that you can't see. But you constantly hear the sort of sound of very fast cars, and then you kind of look at this sort of sad, frozen bicycle rack. And also, that was actually quite an interesting project, because the curator saw this bicycle rack sculpture in the exhibition in Hamburg, where all the bicycles are actually locked to my sculpture. The idea of placing it in the show was very much about placing something from the outside inside the building. And how do you work with that once you go outside, where you're more or less replicating something that's already outdoors? So I kind of had to rethink the whole thing, and in the end we kind of placed the bicycle rack sculpture, we're about to place it in an area where there's absolutely nothing and absolutely no reason to kind of for 50 people to get off their bikes and kind of weld them to the bicycle rack. In the background here you can see a giant earring, which was originally attached to the outside of the Camden Art Centre back in 2006. Back then, the earring established a connection between the inside and the outside of the buildings. Earrings worn in pairs create a balanced, sort of symmetrical look. Single earrings, on the other hand, have a history as expressions of nonconformism and confidence. In its first outing, the earring was supposed to add an imbalance to a rational, symmetrical facade designed by Orr as part of Tony Fretton's redesign of the Camden Art Centre at the time. Later, we wanted to pierce the earring into the outside of the Galerie der Gegenwart, a museum in Hamburg, in which collection the earring is now, which is designed by the late Oswald Ungers, who was quite the star architect in Germany. And in both cases, the architects were strictly against having my earring violate their facades. Oswald Ungers actually also, he succeeded in it, so we couldn't pierce it in, and threatened not so much. The vertical awning sculptures from 2016 and reminiscent of Brancusi's Enthus column and my own Cusina steel sculptures. They're custom made. Is it louder when I speak here? Is this also? No, sorry. They're custom made awnings standing upright in support structures conceived especially for this purpose. Textiles are often used to appropriate, divide, privatize, shape, domesticate, and generally produce public space, which has to do with their material qualities. Textiles are flexible, permeable, and stretchable. On the other hand, we perceive them as harmless and unthreatening. A textile border always appears negotiable. So basically, the mechanism is ready-made, and I have the sort of fabrics custom-made, and then I design stands in order for the fabric part to stand upright. The length of the fabrics of the vertical awnings can cover up to 12 square meters, but they're only ever displayed in this sort of rolled-up compact form. Space is an abstract potential here, but also a variable to be constantly redefined. In the background here, you can see a series of works called Croissants and Architecture, which are photographs framed next to sheets of sandpaper. The whole project started as an artist's book in 2017. Both the framed versions and the artist's book combine portraits of croissants that I shot in different European cafes with sheets of sandpaper. And the book, and I display the photographs with the fronts as well as the backs of the sandpaper. I've been collecting sandpaper for a very long time, so I've been fascinated by the sort of grainy surface, also being slightly appalled by it. It's probably the only surface that I have an almost physical reaction to. I get a really sort of dry, papery mouth. And I think it has to do with the sound, actually, rather than anything else. It's something that I immediately associate with it when I see it. I immediately kind of, anyway. And it's just the color of the surface, the grainy stuff, those sort of differences in it, but also this sort of weird numbers that are printed on the back and that relate to the different grades of abrasiveness. And sometimes you get logos as well. But with most of the sandpaper, the sort of numbers printed on the back almost appear hand printed. There's so many mistakes in them. Anyway, I'm getting a bit into blah blah. For me, as a sculpture-producing artist, croissants are first of all an interesting three-dimensional shape created by rolling out and repeatedly folding thin dough. Once baked, the volume of puff pastry croissants is mainly air, so a well-made croissant would sort of crumble to almost nothing when exposed to pressure. Outside of France, croissants are lifestyle pastries, symptoms of the first gentrification wave of the 1980s and globalized tastes. Today, croissants are a bit passé, a slightly outdated form of the good life, replaced by avocado on toast fin. Sandpaper, on the other hand, produces negative space by removing material. It is a tool and a surface at the same time. No. It's weird, like you either should read or you shouldn't read and say open. When you mix it, it ends up being slightly weird. But stay with me. So the juxtaposition of sandpaper with photographs of croissants examines changing dynamics between two and three-dimensional space, production and consumption, discomfort and enjoyment, but also male and female associated forms. And this is a picture of the original book. And obviously with a book, there's the added sort of effect of that very slowly the sandpaper will destroy the other pages of the book and kind of sort of a book that destroys itself from the inside. And the untitled chairs, which some of you may remember from the Turnipas show here at Tramway, had their own sort of separate space at the back of the Kunstrhein. Shall I even talk about these? I mean, you're all sick of seeing them. They consist of the sort of variations of the Marcel Breuer Cesca chair and different secondhand fur coats. And they kind of address structures of ritualized social relations and the material manifestations through which they are communicated. I removed backrests and the seats of the original chairs and replaced them with newly upholstered seats and secondhand fur coats from different fashion eras, which were given new linings, matching the color of the original seats. chairs themselves are originals and variations, as I said. So what's usually, the idea was what's usually a temporary sort of ritual in public space that you put, you sort of put your jacket over the backrest of a chair in a restaurant or a waiting area or a cafe to kind of mark this as your chair, that that becomes a sort of a feature of the object, and so the jacket and the chair are basically one object, and the sort of coded appropriation and occupation of public space becomes a feature of the chair. And this is a series called Dishwashing Sculptures, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more in the second half of the talk. And this is the sort of last piece I'm going to show from this exhibition. It's a large double sand table. Since 2000 or so, I've been working with something that between ashtrays and sculptures. And the idea at the beginning was to kind of produce minimalist sculpture that you would ash into, that to kind of have a disrespectful gesture towards a minimalist sculpture that seems so awe-inspiring. And later on, these sort of, first of all, there were standing ashtrays, and later on, the whole thing kind of expanded. And I started sort of combining the function of an ashtray with large modular office furniture. And I kind of like this sort of idea of mixing notions of work leisure time. And addiction, of course. And here's a key, just to remind you what that looks like. I'm going to show a video now, which is the oldest work in the show, and I made it at the very end of my time in Hamburg at art school. appearances. I saw that was, I kind of relaxed. I thought, oh, this is all over now. And I relaxed a little bit too much. The sort of, I've made this video in sort of several semi-public buildings, and there was a lot of trespassing involved. They're sort of buildings where you either have, you know, congress centers or luxury hotels or corporate foyers, buildings where you actually have to kind of be part of the sort of group of people that have access. And the idea was to kind of create, because also that's what the film montage does, to create a sort of endless building consisting out of all these various ceilings that appear to be, that now appear to be the floor. So it's about appropriating architecture to kind of appropriate space, to kind of produce space where there actually wasn't accessible space before. And kind of quite literally referring to Michel de Certeau's notion of walking as making space. He talks about walking as one of the sort of practices, practices in urban life of making space, practices of everyday life. And this was the sort of half-time video, and I, now I'm kind of continuing with the sort of second half of my talk, which is an extract of a presentation I gave during a seminar about maintenance art by my colleague Maria Muhle at the Art Academy in Munich last year. It wasn't my seminar. Maria Muhle is a philosophy professor in Munich, and before she invited me to give a presentation, I had never actually thought about my work having, or my work relating to, in particular, to maintenance art. I knew about maintenance art, but that was about it. So maintenance art was a small and slightly obscure art movement in the 1960s and 70s. Its manifesto, drawn up by the artist Mirle Lademann-Lukulis, was a reaction, which is this lady, was a reaction to the contradictions she perceived between taking up a vocation within society, a conception of herself as an artist, and her new role as a mother. Her answer was that she would be a maintenance worker, and she stated that from now on she would produce maintenance art. A lot of her and other artists of this association with this movement, like for instance Billy Apple, a lot of their output involved activities such as cleaning buildings, museums, and art galleries mainly, and maintaining various infrastructure, but also reflecting on issues around art and labor. Give you a very brief idea. And now I have to switch. For someone who grew up as a provincial punk rocker in the 80s, the central terminology associated with maintenance art, care, especially self-care, sounds a little bit suspicious. Verschwende deine Jugend, literally translated waste your youth, is a song by the Düsseldorf band Deutsche Amerikanische Freundschaft, or DAF, from 1983, and a book named after the song by Jürgen Teitel. Both state, without at the time being equipped with the vocabulary of neoliberalism, that terms such as care, self-care, and maintenance are techniques that support the status quo and need to be avoided. Instead, you were supposed to waste your time, body, and health. This, of course, is a total rock and roll cliche, but maybe one that can be looked back upon with a certain sentimentality in the age of self-optimization. Looking at the maintenance art movement more closely, there are actually a few, or many actually, related terms of movements such as materialist feminism, reproductive labor, institutional critique, art and labor, wages for houseworks that interest me, but only very few aspects that I see in relation to my own work. The issue of reproductive labor, the close entanglement of art and life, or the politicization of everyday life, and most importantly, an intense and physical relationship with architecture. The condensation of art and life on a personal level has to do with the fact that I've almost continuously lived and worked in one place since 1997. Not the same place, of course, but nearly always accommodating both activities in one single space. Living and working in a big city was practically the only goal in my provincial teenage life in the 80s, a goal that I achieved surprisingly early on, moving to Hamburg on my 18th birthday. The The transition from small town in Nordrhein-Westphalia to Hamburg was not smooth, but friction was definitely something that interested me. Ram Koolhaas describes the delirious New York cities as a condensation of opposites and contradictions. The book is based on Koolhaas' experiences in New York in the mid-70s, when big city centers offered a variety of loopholes for subcultures, artists, as well as crime, and when hardly anyone wanted to live in them. Central square meters were cheap and thus enabled all kinds of art forms and movements. Since the late 90s, however, life in the metropolises has become unaffordable. In order to continue my declared aim in life, to live in the centre, there was only one way for me and many others after art school, which was to work in our tiny apartments. Of course, artists working in their at home suffer the stigma of the amateur. Despite the increasing repeal of the separation of life and work in post-Fordism, after all, everything is work now, the myth of the pain-splashing male artist working in a large, well-lit studio is a stubborn one in the art world. The home environment, on the other hand, has a female connotation and suspiciously smells of cottage industry. The flats I've worked in and the commercial premises where I've lived have always been complemented by the surrounding urban center. I did and do spend a lot of time in public and semi-public spaces in the city, taking pictures in cafes, parks, and department stores, and trespassing when necessary. The city kind of became a focal point for my work, and my cramped live-in studio a kind of fusion of antechamber and post-production unit. The physical proximity to art production and its focused atmosphere can recharge everyday practices, such as getting dressed, washing clothes, and cleaning in the inhabited studio. The repetitive daily actions, processing oneself and one's surroundings, can become almost performative, or will at least be more intensely reflected. Conversely, improvisation, misappropriation, and compromises, all of which are part of everyday life, become the starting point for new artworks. A specific series of work directly a result of my domestic work situations are the dishwashing sculptures that I've been producing since 2013, which you briefly saw earlier in the Hamburg Kunstverein. I do my washing up at home by drying the dishes in a recycled dishwasher basket on top of my washing machine. The actual sculptures that were inspired by that are precariously unstable, temporary piles of dishes, glass, and kitchen utensils, also arranged in modified dishwasher baskets on pedestals. The everyday functional arrangements of dishes to dry after washing up is now a formal composition of a select collection containing both valuable antique porcelain as well as cheap ceramics and eccentric kitchen utensils. The precarious structures are not fixed and must be restacked for each exhibition. The simple activity of everyday life becomes a sculptural act. Positive and negative shapes are wedged, piled up, clamped together, condensed, so to speak. The selection of elements follows static considerations as well as aesthetic ones. The sculptures combine masculine connotated architectural concepts with housework and the domestic sphere as materialized forms of female reproductive labor. I've been through this without ever changing the slide. Here are several other examples of the dishwashing sculpture. And when I say eccentric kitchen utensils, I mean things like this. So at the left here, not the sugar clamp with the little feet, but above it, is something that's called a Weisswursthebe, which is a tool to lift your Weisswurst, which is a white sausage like that you cook in broth in Munich. And it's shaped, it looks like a gynecological instrument, but it's used to lift the Weisswurst out of your broth. And it's another favorite of mine. Here is a sort of pancake fan for funny shapes on the left. It's a bit of a close-up. Reproductive labor is a term from 1970s materialist feminism that refers to the reproduction of the labor force, the things and processes that must be present so that the male worker can return to work every day, and which were back then performed by almost entirely by women. For instance, physical maintenance and nutrition, such as cooking and cleaning, but also emotional and psychological support, such as listening and sexuality. The term is revisited by Marina Wischmidt in Maps of Refusal, Strategies of Reproduction and Abolition in Materialist Feminism, a text from 2014. She writes that the social construction of gender and the capitalist system of values have internal and logical connections with each other, arguing that combating one must also mean fighting the other, since they are merely points of one equation. This may seem intuitively wrong to us, as the market should surely be able to cope with a series of flexible gender performances, but the idea behind it is that the existence of women is functional and constitutive of a capitalist society. It requires the division into public and private, paid and unpaid, nature and culture, as well as the identification of women with one side of these binaries in its present form. In the photograph next to a text by Ben Gottberg in the book Occupying Architecture, Between the Architect and the User, Carolyn Butterworth poses in 1992 for a somewhat strange performance. She licks the reconstructed Barcelona pavilion by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe as if it were a lollipop or a pair of high-heeled shoes. Her tongue sticks to the travertine, a true fetishistic act. It's nothing more than a fun, slightly disturbing image, but the photo says something about modern architecture. It shows the poverty of our physical relationship to the constructed world. What do our bodies actually do in buildings? We move through them, our eyes look up and down, and sometimes we touch surfaces of stone, steel, and leather to judge their quality. To understand what images and plans and books, magazines, and on-screen represent but cannot show. Everyone knows that the Barcelona Pavilion is an architectural masterpiece, such an iconic building that it was completely reconstructed in the 1980s. Architects and architectural critics wanted to see, in reality, if the building itself was as unbelievable as a few vintage black and white photographs of the 1929 original would suggest. They wanted to touch built reality instead of fetishizing the buildings. Carolyn Butterworth's performance is based on the real object of marble, chrome, and velvet. The pavilion is a fetishistic piece of architecture in terms of material. The visit is not only a spatial, but also a sensual experience. Trained as we are to read graphical representations and consume images in split seconds on Instagram, we've almost forgotten that buildings are made of materials and that these materials have a sensual quality. Not only color and surfaces, but also deep matter and smell, something you want to lick and consume. So I'm about to show another video. For the video, Little Frank and His Cart from 2001, Andrea Fraser shot with hidden camera in the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, built by Franco Piri between 1993 and 1997.
If you haven't already done so, walk away from the desk where you picked up this guide and out into the great high space of the atrium. Isn't this a wonderful place? It's uplifting. It's like a Gothic cathedral. You can feel your soul rise up to the building around you. This is the heart of the museum. And it works like a heart, pumping the visitors around the different galleries. If you look up, you can see walkways, elevators, and stairways leading up or around the walls of the atrium between the galleries. These are the arteries. separate galleries all lie off this central space, and to go from one to another, you must come back here. In the great museums of previous ages, rooms linked from one to another, and you must visit them all, one after another. Sometimes it can feel as if there's no escape. But here there is an escape, this space, to which you can return after every gallery to refresh the spirit before your next encounter with the demands of contemporary art. This building recognizes that modern art is demanding, complicated, bewildering, and the museum tries to make you feel at home so that you can relax and absorb what you see more easily. As you look around, you'll see that every surface in this space curves. Only the floor is straight. These curves are gentle, but in their huge scale, powerfully sensual. You'll see people going up to the walls and stroking them. You might feel a desire to do so yourself. These curving surfaces have a direct appeal that has nothing to do with age or class or education. They give the building its warmth, its welcoming feel. And in this way, the atrium tries to make you feel at home and prepares you for the purpose of the building, the art it contains. Paradoxically, these sensual curves have been created by computer technology. Let's take a closer look at one of the stone-clad pillars in this space. If you stand with your back to the entrance, there's one to your right, holding up a large stone box that actually contains a tiny gallery. Go right up to it. This pillar is clad in panels of limestone. Run your hand over them. Squeeze along the surface. Feel how smooth it is. Because of the way the surface of the pillar curves, each of these panels is slightly different. No two are quite the same. And this is true for all the curved walls of the building. If these panels had been produced by conventional means, this would still be a building site, and the cost of the building would be astronomical. But these panels were cut and shaped by robots, working to a computer program developed for aircraft design. To a computer, the mathematical problems involved in fitting together this vast jigsaw are simple. This process is very new, and it should have a revolutionary effect on the way architects work, because it'll allow them to embody more freely the productions of their imagination, as well as allowing them to build more cheaply and to a better quality. Now turn to your right, and look at the glass tower that contains two of the elevators. The glass surface of this tower also curves. And again, the curves are produced by panels fitted together, but here they overlap like the scales of a fish. This is no idle metaphor. The architect who designed this building has always found inspiration in fish. He dates this obsession from the days when he used to go with his grandmother to market to buy a live carp, which she would then take home and keep in the bathtub until it was time to cook it. Here, little Frank would play with the carp, and here the magic of its sinuous, scaly form somehow entered his bloodstream. If you look to your left now, beyond the pillar, under the stone box that we looked at a moment ago, you'll see the entrance to a large space. This is the largest gallery in the museum, and believe it or not, it's known as the Fish Gallery, because the long, curving shape of this part of the building is derived, once again, from the shape of the fish. Let's go in there now. Press your pause button until you're in the gallery. In a room of 3,200 square meters. It's 150 meters long and between 12 and 25 meters high. Contemporary art is big. In fact, some of it is enormous. And this gallery was designed to accommodate the huge pieces that artists have begun to create. Walk over to the left-hand side of the gallery and look up at the ceiling. You'll see a lighting gantry hanging from it, and above that, a skylight. There are skylights like these throughout the building, but they're not intended to light the audience in the gallery.
Like most of Fraser's work, the video is a critical look at the museum as an institution. It is based on an unauthorized intervention and she recalls a relieved smile when she hears the museum wants her to feel comfortable here. She becomes more thoughtful as the guide draws her attention to the powerfully sensual curves whose direct impact is independent of age, class, or education. She is thrilled and even lifts her dress and begins rubbing against the pillar. No one stops her, for she only does what the audio guide advises. Little Frank and his carp was inspired by the text of the audio guide, a particularly embarrassing example of the way corporate museums repackage artistic transgression, subversion, and sensuality. Biological metaphors and sexually suggestive anecdotes are combined with images of technical wonders to create something like a smorgasbord of museological seduction in the age of globalization and neoliberalism. Of course, the whole thing also shows how ridiculous these audio guides can be and how any attempt to impart architecture to large groups of tourists is condemned to a certain banality and failure. Significantly, Thibaut de Ruyter's analysis of Fraser's video and Butterworth's performance, which appeared in an issue of 2007 Estonian Architectural Review titled Licking Architecture, ignores one key point here. Two female feminist artists lick architecture produced by male star architects, in a way appropriating it and expanding their territory. In John Waters' 1972 film Pink Flamingos, Divine and her grown-up son execute similar physical interactions with less prominent everyday architecture. The pair breaks into the apartment owned by the Marble family, a family they are competing and fighting with. They rub against and lick off the entire interior of the Marble's home and its furniture. The goal is to curse the other family with this practice. The two of them get sexually aroused by the cursing ritual, and the whole thing ends in typical John Waters manner in a trashily staged blowjob. In addition to the fetishizing plot, the licking of interiors by Butterworth, Fraser, and Waters could be described as ritualized, regressive, and territorial acts designed to claim, consume, appropriate, and take over architecture. That's more or less the end. The production of space and the appropriation of architecture through rituals and techniques in everyday life will now culminate with the final video,